Hello there. Welcome. Today is Friday, December 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a day after the president's impeachment, Democrats who want to take his job have been duking it out in their sixth debate. Republicans and Democrats are at a stalemate over the impeachment trial, leaving no clear time frame for an impeachment trial.
It is tragic that the president's reckless actions make impeachment necessary. He gave us no choice.
Also ahead, Star Wars fans are rejoicing on this weekend before Christmas. It's all on today's International Edition. Support for President Trump's impeachment and criticism of his economy were two big topics that dominated early moments of Thursday night's debate with the Democratic Party's leading presidential contenders. The debate, the sixth in the cycle, was set in the heart of the holiday season and, of course, just a day after the House's historic vote to impeach Trump, raising the prospect that it may draw the smallest audience yet, but not the smallest stakes. It was a pretty big tug of war there with the passionate progressives and pragmatic moderates. Let's talk more about it with VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. He is here live in studio. Jim, well, the candidates seem to definitely be aligned on at least one thing, and that was criticism of the president.
Yeah, and it kind of went off the rails from there.
Yeah.
This was the liveliest debate we've had since they started in June. This was a significant moment because there were lots of clashes, and it involved primarily the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, Pete Buttigieg, who's been rising in the polls. He's in the top tier of the Democratic contenders. But most importantly, Buttigieg is in the lead, though be it narrowly, in Iowa. That's the state that votes first on February 3rd, kicks everything off. So there is a furious scramble now among people like Elizabeth Warren and Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg, all of whom need to register a good showing in Iowa. Buttigieg basically became a target tonight on a couple of issues and really squared off with Warren and Klobuchar at different times. There was also another clash near the end between Joe Biden, the front runner, the former vice president, and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. The issue was the health care plan known as Medicare for All that Sanders and Warren support. Progressives like it, moderates warn against it. And this also flared up during the debate. So we had quite a spirited debate. I'm not sure how many people were watching, though, because here in the U.S., we're so close to the Christmas holidays.
Right. But of course, people will sort of check into what happened if they didn't see it. And definitely some of the bigger headlines. What do you think they'll be? The sparring and it was the young versus the old in some ways. I remember there was one question that referred to former President Barack Obama, some comments that he recently made about how women, if women led the world, and then he also continued that things would be better, and then he continued with, and the old white men need to get out of the way, and the first person they went to was Bernie Sanders, and then, of course, Joe Biden. Both of them, how do you think they handled that?
Well, there is an age issue in the Democratic primary. The clash between Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg had to do, to some extent, with government experience. He has argued he is an outsider and that his lack of experience, in a way, is an asset. He brings a fresh perspective. Buttigieg has also been critical of Warren and Bernie Sanders for their sweeping programs on the economy, on targeting the wealthy, and on health care. So Buttigieg has set himself up to be kind of a target in this debate. At one point, he did become pretty angry talking about his military experience in an exchange with Klobuchar. He got into it in a real lively clash with Warren over campaign fundraising. And so this is all important in a sense because those voters in Iowa now are weighing this as they make their decisions. And who are they going to give a boost to come February 3rd?
Right. It seemed like Klobuchar was definitely stepping up her game tonight. She was really in it today. She was there. And when she went after Buttigieg for that, it looked like she was defending the former vice president. And just experience in general is not necessarily always being a bad thing.
Well, and Biden, who's been criticized in past debates, had a reasonably strong debate from most appearances. And here's the other thing. When you're somewhat on the sidelines, when candidates are going at one another, they don't always benefit from that. The people that often benefit are the ones on the sidelines because they're a little bit removed from it. And so whether this helps or hurts Buttigieg, Warren, Klobuchar, it's hard to say right now. But certainly, I think a number of Democrats felt compelled to attack Buttigieg tonight because they saw him rising in the polls in Iowa and they needed to find a way to slow him down. The same thing happened with Elizabeth Warren some months ago, where Biden and others kind of criticized her on Medicare for All and slowed her momentum. So we're getting this thing where Biden continues to ride at the top, not by a great margin, but by a fairly consistent one. And now Sanders has actually been more consistent of late, has moved into second place in a lot of the polls. So it's going to be an interesting dynamic for the next 6 or 7 weeks.
Absolutely. And of course, it seemed like there was a lot more substance. There were a lot less people on stage, so they had more time to talk.
That's a key part of it right there, that they did have time to shine. The answers were a little longer. And it also sparked these clashes, which are a little more entertaining.
Okay. So who did anyone win?
No, I don't like to proclaim winners on these things. You know, some people tend to have stronger nights, others less so. I think Buttigieg will be given extra scrutiny to see how he did. I do think Biden and Sanders and Klobuchar had reasonably strong nights. So.
And last question, was this the last debate for the Democratic presidential candidates before the first primary in February?
No, there's another one scheduled now in January before we get to Iowa. So there'll be one in Iowa.
All right, we'll see what happens then. Thank you so much.
Sure.
That's VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. We appreciate it. Well, Congress has headed home for the holidays, leaving plans and possible timeline for President Donald Trump's impeachment trial in disarray. Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi insisting Thursday Senate Republicans must provide details on witnesses and testimony before she will send over the charges for Trump's trial.
We'd like to see a fair process, but we'll see what they have, and we'll be ready for whatever it is. Yes, Chad.
Is that the requirement? You need to see a fair process before.
We would hope there would be a fair process, just as we hope that they would honor the Constitution.
Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has so far said it is an unfair impeachment, that he will not allow new witnesses. Democrats want and favors a swift trial.
Speaker Pelosi's House just gave into a temptation that every other house in our history has managed to resist. They impeach a president whom they do not even allege has committed an actual crime known to our laws. They've impeached simply because they disagree with a presidential act and question the motive behind it.
Well, McConnell, after that meeting, or after meeting with his Senate Democratic counterpart, Chuck Schumer said there was no agreement.
Leader McConnell is plotting the most rushed, least thorough, and most unfair impeachment trial in modern history. His plan to prevent House managers from calling witnesses to prove their case is a dramatic break from precedent. We heard a lot about precedent from the leader. Never has there been a presidential impeachment trial in which the majority prevented the House managers from fairly presenting their case, to have witnesses explain their knowledge of the alleged malfeasance.
McConnell, who has drawn criticism for saying he will not be an impartial juror, said Democrats were too afraid to send the charges to the Senate, where Trump would be expected to be acquitted by the Republican majority. As for Trump, at a rally in Michigan as the impeachment hearing was underway Wednesday night, he told the crowd of supporters he's not concerned.
I'm not worried because it's always good when you don't do anything wrong, you get impeached. That may be a record that will last forever. But you know what they have done? They've cheapened the impeachment process.
Associated Press Washington Bureau Chief Julie Pace reporting that Trump has already made history as the first president to run for re-election after being impeached in the House, and if he wins.
Certainly, if he is able to win re-election, even having been impeached, he will see that as real vindication. He will see that as a real sign that he can triumph over great adversity, over the biggest constitutional marker that is out there to curb his powers.
Most analysts say if there is a trial, the Senate will not vote to remove Trump from office. Democrats worry if Trump is not held accountable, he will be dangerously emboldened to do as he pleases. Here are some of the stories we're following at VOANews.com. Russian President Vladimir Putin is weighing in on the Trump impeachment, hinting at staying in power as well. U.S. Congress approves a massive funding bill to avert government shutdown. Pakistan is seeking the removal of a judge who ordered a public hanging of their former prime minister. And the impeachment novelty items are starting to show up online. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Pakistan is accusing India of deploying medium-range missiles in the disputed Kashmir region, actions it says are only leading to an escalation of tensions between the two countries that already have a long adversarial history. Pakistan says India is setting the stage for a cross-border military attack that will harm regional peace. My colleague Steve Miller talks to reporter Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad about the latest rising tensions between the two adversarial strains that have for years threatened peace in the region.
Ayaz, can you let us know what has been alleged and what do we really know about the allegations about these missiles being deployed?
Well, today in Pakistan, an unusual statement was issued by the Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi. It was a video statement, and what he said was that the Pakistani intelligence agencies have reported that there has been a massive military movement along the line of control in Kashmir, which divides the Himalayan region between India and Pakistan, and that even Indian military has deployed medium-range missiles. So what the foreign minister of Pakistan said, that he has written a letter to the United Nations Security Council informing the council about this dangerous escalation that he says could be an attempt to launch an attack against Pakistan.
Ayaz, can you do us a favor and walk us back a few months to tell us how we got here?
Well, this is basically, these current tensions stem from the steps that the Indian government took in August when it basically unilaterally changed the status of Kashmir and made it part of India, whereas Pakistan has consistently said that the fate of Kashmir has to be decided by the United Nations Security Council, that it remains a dispute under the Security Council resolutions. But India went ahead with it, and that's when, you know, Pakistan immediately downgraded its diplomatic ties with India, although they were already, facing a lot of challenges, the relationship. But since then, we have seen constant statements back and forth between military officials and political leaders in both the countries about some kind of a dangerous escalation taking place, particularly in Kashmir, and that Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan has repeatedly warned that it could lead to a war and that could, you know, escalate into a nuclear exchange between the two countries. So we have been seeing this escalation. But whatever happened has happened over the last 24 hours is significant, because first, the Indian military chief, in a statement on Wednesday, said that there could be an escalation in tensions with Pakistan in Kashmir anytime. And that was sort of an alarm, for Pakistan. And maybe Pakistan already knew about the steps that India has taken. So that's why today Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi went ahead.
Of course, all of this is taking place under a communications blackout for those that are in Kashmir pretty much since all this began a few months ago.
And Pakistan has been consistently demanding and urging the world community to, pay attention to this issue and force India to lift this blockade. And that is why this Pakistan trying to internationalize this dispute with India over Kashmir has obviously annoyed India, which has consistently maintained that both the countries have to resolve this issue bilaterally rather than going to any international forum. So India is not happy and Pakistan is not happy. And both countries have already fought three wars, two of them over Kashmir. And we once again see quite a dangerous escalation with latest claims of Pakistan that even medium-range missiles India has deployed in Kashmir for some kind of, preparation for a conflict with Pakistan.
Ayaz Ghul is in Islamabad. Thank you very much for joining us and providing this update.
Thank you, Steve.
Countries and companies attending a refugee forum in Geneva this week pledged to boost support for refugees' access to clean energy, among other goals. Findings show that renewables offer multiple benefits, including reducing some of the root causes of displacement. For VOA, Lisa Bryant reports on what this means for Africa, which hosts roughly one quarter of the world's refugees.
Access to energy is one of the biggest challenges facing Africa, especially for refugees. Energy is crucial for cooking and heat and to power refugee schools and health clinics. Getting it often means cutting trees for firewood and charcoal.
The hosting communities are shouldering those burdens because there is an environmental degradation and depletion because of hosting many refugees.
Well, the current situation for energy in Africa is pretty poor, pathetic. Like 90% of refugee locations and the surrounding settlements often have no access to sustainable, affordable energy.
The UN Refugee Agency has launched a four-year strategy to transition to clean, renewable energy in its refugee camps. It's already rolling out green projects, including in several African countries. That means teaming up with organizations like this Spanish group, which includes three power companies. Alianza Shield is extending Ethiopia's energy grid to refugee camps in the north and building solar energy systems.
We are deploying on the field one of the best experts on grid management, on solar energy, on lighting, and also they are approaching the project with another view, like the view of sustainability on the long term.
New findings show the clean energy transition makes financial as well as environmental sense. However, it still means convincing private companies who may fear investing in refugees is risky.
We're basically saying the market for renewable energy in Africa is not, let's say, 6-7 million refugees. It's 1.2 billion people. So we've got to look at it as a much more part of a rural electrification process across the whole continent.
For now, many refugees have limited energy options. The most polluting are contributing to climate change, which is helping to drive ever more people from their homes. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Geneva.
Pancreatic cancer. It's one of the deadliest kinds of cancer there is because it is almost always found too late. This cancer is hard to detect and symptoms only show up when the cancer has advanced. But as VOA's Carol Pearson reports, researchers are beginning to make inroads in this most difficult to diagnose disease.
U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has survived pancreatic cancer, not once, but twice. Hers was found early, which is rare. The pancreas is an important organ that produces insulin, a hormone that regulates the body's blood sugar. But the pancreas is hard to see. It's at the back of the abdomen, covered by the stomach and the liver. That's why doctors can't detect early tumors during routine physical exams. Dr. Somashekhar Krishna is an endocrinologist who says that's why only 9% of patients diagnosed with pancreatic cancer are alive 5 years after diagnosis.
The cancer doesn't produce any symptoms early on.
Patricia Beatty likes playing cards with her children. She went to the hospital with what she thought was a stomach virus. During a scan of her stomach, the doctor found a cyst.
He told me that that the cyst was there and that it was precancerous.
Pancreatic cancer develops in one of two ways. It either starts as a cancerous tumor or it starts when a cyst changes and becomes cancerous. The difference between a tumor and the cyst is that the tumor is firm, while a pancreatic cyst is filled with fluid. Cysts on the pancreas are common. Most are, fortunately, benign. Doctors can test fluid from inside the cyst, but it's hard to tell which cysts will develop into cancer. Cancerous tumors or cysts can be detected with sonograms or other diagnostic imaging tools, but imaging is so expensive it can't be used as a regular screening device. Dr. Krishna at the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center led a study of a new diagnostic method that gives doctors a microscopic view of the cyst wall. He says his study showed this virtual biopsy is highly accurate.
We can diagnose cysts with an accuracy of 96% to 97%.
The procedure uses a tiny scope that emits a laser light to produce a cellular image of the inside of the cyst.
Looking at the wall, the pattern, the image pattern which comes from the cyst wall, which comes as a direct video feed in real time, we can conclude what the diagnosis is.
Krishna and others are training doctors at hospitals across the U.S. to use this new technology so they can more accurately diagnose precancerous cysts. This can save lives, but the procedure will only be used after an MRI or a sonogram is ordered for another reason, so the cancer will still grow silently in most people until it's too late to save them. Krishna told VOA that a blood test is the most logical way to find pancreatic cancer early. The problem is it hasn't been developed yet, although researchers are working on it. As for Patricia Beatty, she's cancer-free because this new diagnostic tool found her cyst before it became malignant and spread. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
And you're listening to International Edition, back in a minute.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, the holiday season is always a popular time for going to the movies in the United States when people have a lot of time off and the weather is cold. Now, joining us to talk about two big new movies being released this weekend is Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. Jeff, Star Wars fans have been waiting for this a long time and it is finally here.
I did, and you know, I'm Generation X, so I was one of those 11-year-old kids who saw Star Wars back in 1977, teenager when I saw Empire Strikes Back, and of course, I got permission in high school from my teachers to ditch to go see Return of the Jedi, so I am a huge fan of Star Wars. And also, you know, I don't count the George Lucas movies from the 90s, they're terrible, and I love J.J. Abrams and what he's done with this series, and this is the third installment, the final of the trilogy, starting with The Force Awakens, and then we had The Last Jedi, and now we end the trilogy with Rise of Skywalker, to the point where, like, Luke, I'm your father, those kind of spoilers. So I'm just going to give you my reaction to this movie. I'm not going to give any details. If I try to talk about this too much, we will ruin the movie, and there's a lot of things happening. So this is kind of the swan song from J.J. Abrams and Star Wars fans, ending the trilogy with the original cast. And, you know, overall, the movie, it's not my favorite in the whole series. So I had such an emotional connection to The Last Jedi because it was original characters, and it just reminded me of my childhood. And it just, for someone of my generation, it really, really satisfied me ending the series. So now this is really Daisy Ridley's movie. She plays Rey. This is her journey. This is her there's so many spoilers in this, Lori. It's unbelievable. So I just think that sometimes the movie gets bogged down because it could be like three movies in one. There's so much of the story going on. The action sequences and the special effects have never been in question. It's just that it gets bogged down with so much going on, especially the third act. So much is going by, and they're trying to resolve everything at the speed, which is the wrong movie, I know. But overall, I'm mixed on the movie. Now, I didn't hate it. Like, a lot of critics are trashing this movie. Like, it's the worst Star Wars movie ever. Absolutely not. The worst Star Wars movies are back in the 90s. So this is not the worst Star Wars movie. The critics are being too harsh on it. I think if you're a Star Wars fan, you're going to love it. The younger generation, this is their movie. So it's going to be a big success.
And then we've got another film that's making a lot of headlines with Adam Sandler, Uncut Gems.
Yes, Uncut Gems. You know, Adam Sandler is known for his comedies, you know, Happy Gilmore and 41st Dates and 51st Dates. There's so many great comedic roles he's done. But people forget he's a dramatic actor, too. And he waits for a really good project to come along. I loved him in Punch Drunk Love. That's one of my favorite movies, one of my favorite performances for him. This is from the Safdie brothers, who have given him a role of a lifetime. He plays this swarthy jeweler in Manhattan, in the jewelry district. And he's a gambler. He can't stop placing huge bets, and he keeps taking people's jewelry on commission, selling them, pawning them, placing bets, until he's so over his head that the loan sharks are after him. So when you see him in this movie, you're just going to be surprised that just not only has he got incredible dramatic chops, but he's just the most unlikable character, the most dirty, low-down. The Safdie brothers really drag us into this underworld of gambling. He's horrible to his family. His wife is played by Idina Menzel. And of course, you know, the Las Vegas Film Critics Society, we gave out our awards last week, and we gave it to Adam Sandler. He won Best Actor. So everyone's saying, you know, Oscar buzz, you know, Joaquin Phoenix as the Joker. Yes, rightly so. But you watch out. The dark horse will be Adam Sandler in this incredible role in Uncut Gems.
Wow, that's quite an endorsement. All right, well, we always appreciate your perspective. Jeffrey K. Howard, you can find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. Jeff, thanks so much, and happy holidays.
You too. Thank you. Merry Christmas and happy holidays.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no.
The first ever Amy Winehouse exhibit in the United States will debut at the Grammy Museum in Los Angeles next month. The Recording Academy told the Associated Press Thursday that the late British singer's popular outfits, including her halter dress, worn at her final stage performance in Belgrade in 2011, never before seen handwritten lyrics and home video, journal entries, and more from her family's personal archive will make up Beyond Black, the Style of Amy Winehouse. That's what it's called, the exhibit, which will open January 17th and run through mid-April. Winehouse died July 23rd of 2011 at her London home from an accidental alcohol poisoning at the age of only 27 years old. She had only released two albums, but had a tremendous impact on music fans and her peers, being praised for her jazz-like vocals and honest lyrics. She also won 5 Grammys at the 2008 show, which she couldn't attend because she was rejected for a U.S. work visa. The singer, whose hits included Rehab and You Know I'm No Good, was also known for her distinctive look, including her beehive hairdo, cat eyeliner, ballet shoes, tattoos, and more. Well, you've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Tony Pollack. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day. Me, yeah, baby.